The conference of 1923 was the culmination of long planning on the part of Lord Darlington. As I recall, he had not been initially so preoccupied with the peace treaty when it was drawn up at the end of the Great War, and I think it is fair to say that his interest was prompted by his friendship with Herr Karl-Heinz Bremann. Herr Bremann first visited Darlington Hall very shortly after the war, and it was evident to any observer that he and Lord Darlington had struck up a close friendship. This did not surprise me, since one could see at a glance that Herr Bremann was a gentleman of great decency. He returned again at fairly regular intervals, and one could not help noticing, with some alarm, the deterioration he underwent from one visit to the next. It must have been towards the end of 1920 that Lord Darlington made the first of a number of trips to Berlin himself, and I can remember the profound effect it had on him. But there is another memory that has remained with me very vividly in relation to this matter. One winter's night, Lord Darlington was dining with a solitary guest. I believe it was Sir Richard Fox, a colleague from his lordship's Foreign Office days, in the vastness of the banqueting hall. I decided to minimize my presence by standing in the shadows much further away from table than I might usually have done. And it was as I was standing like that in the shadow that I heard Lord Darlington talk about Herr Bremann. "He was my enemy," he was saying, "but he always behaved like a gentleman. I said to him, 'Look here, we're enemies now, and I'll fight you with all I've got. But when this wretched business is over, we shan't have to be enemies any more, and we'll have a drink together. The wretched thing is, this treaty is making a liar out of me.'" And it was a little later that same night that his lordship said, shaking his head, "I fought that war to preserve justice in this world, as far as I understood. I wasn't taking part in a vendetta against the German race." And when today one hears talk about his lordship, when one hears the sort of foolish speculations concerning his motives, I am pleased to recall the memory of that moment as he spoke those heartfelt words in the near empty banqueting hall. It was not long after that evening there came the sad news that Herr Bremann had shot himself in a train between Hamburg and Berlin. It is my belief that even without this tragic news, Lord Darlington would have set upon the course he took. As it was, in the weeks that followed Herr Bremann's death, his lordship began to devote more and more hours to the matter of the crisis in Germany. Powerful and famous gentlemen became regular visitors to the house, and I was instructed to make sure the staff did not learn their identities, or in some cases, even glimpse them. However, Lord Darlington never made any efforts to conceal things from my own eyes and ears. Steadily, then, his lordship, together with Sir David Cardinal, who became his closest ally during that time, succeeded in gathering together a broad alliance of figures who shared the conviction that the situation in Germany should not be allowed to persist. By the turn of 1922, his lordship was working with a clear goal in mind. This was to gather under the very roof of Darlington Hall the most influential of the gentlemen whose support had been won, with a view to conducting an unofficial international conference, a conference that would discuss the means by which the harshest terms of the Versailles Treaty could be revised. I can remember one morning around this time bringing Lord Darlington coffee in the breakfast room, and his saying to me as he folded the Times with some disgust, "Frenchman. Really, I mean to say, Stevens, Frenchman." "Yes, sir. And to think we have to be seen by the world to be arm in arm with them. One wishes for a good bath at the mere reminder." But the very fact that the French were the most intransigent as regards releasing Germany from the cruelties of the Versailles Treaty made all the more imperative the need to bring to the gathering at Darlington Hall at least one French gentleman with unambiguous influence over his country's foreign policy. Finally, having secured the agreement of a certain extremely illustrious Frenchman, I will merely call him Monsieur Dupont, to attend the gathering, the date for the conference was set. That is to say, for that memorable march of 1923. As the date grew ever nearer, the pressures on myself were not inconsequential. I was only too aware of the possibility that if any guest were to find his stay at Darlington Hall less than comfortable, this might have repercussions of unimaginable largeness. I thus set about preparing for the days ahead, as I imagine a general might prepare for battle. I devised with utmost care a special staff plan, anticipating all sorts of eventualities. I even gave the staff a military-style pep talk. "History could well be made under this roof," I told them. You will understand, then, something of the climate prevailing around Darlington Hall by the time of my father's fall in front of the summer house, and what I mean when I say there was little room for any beating about the bush. My father did, in any case, rapidly discover a way to circumvent the stricture that he should carry no laden trays. The sight of his figure pushing a trolley loaded with cleaning utensils, arranged incongruously though always tidily around teapots, cups and saucers, became a familiar one around the house. As for Miss Kenton, I seem to remember the mounting tension of those days having a noticeable effect upon her. I recall, for instance, the occasion I happened to encounter her in the back corridor. I paused as she approached and said, "Ah, Miss Kenton, I wonder if I may draw your attention to the fact that the bed linen for the upper floor will need to be ready by the day after tomorrow." "The matter is perfectly under control, Mr. Stevens." I was about to continue on my way, but Miss Kenton did not move. Then she took one step more towards me, so that a bar of light fell across her face, and I could see the angry expression on it. "Unfortunately, Mr. Stevens, I am extremely busy now, and I am finding I have barely a single moment to spare. If only I had as much spare time as you evidently do, then I would happily reciprocate by wandering about this house, reminding you of tasks you have perfectly well in hand. If you have so much time to spare, I suggest it might be more profitably spent taking some fresh air." Irritating as Miss Kenton's behaviour was, I could not afford to give it much thought, for by then the first of the guests had arrived. The representatives from abroad were not expected for a further 2 or 3 days, but the 3 gentlemen referred to by his lordship as his home team, 2 Foreign Office ministers and Sir David Cardinal, had come early to prepare the ground as thoroughly as possible. Overwhelmingly, their concerns centred on a single figure, that of Monsieur Dupont, the French gentleman, and on his likely sympathies and antipathies. Now, it was in the midst of these preliminary discussions that his lordship entrusted me with a mission sufficiently unusual for it to have remained in my memory to this day. Lord Darlington called me into his study, and I could see at once that he was in a state of some agitation.
Stevens, he began with a false air of nonchalance. Stevens, I realize this is a somewhat irregular thing to ask you to do. It's just that one has so much of importance on one's hand just now.
I would be very glad to be of assistance, sir.
You are familiar, I take it, with the facts of life.
I'm afraid I don't quite follow you, sir.
Well, let me put my cards on the table, Stevens. Sir David is a very old friend, and he's been invaluable in organizing the present conference. Now, he's brought his son, Reginald, with him to act as secretary. The point is, he's engaged to be married. Young Reginald, I mean.
Yes, sir.
Sir David has been attempting to tell his son facts of life for the last 5 years. Now, I happen to be the young man's godfather. Accordingly, Sir David has requested that I convey to young Reginald the facts of life.
Do I understand, sir, I said, that you wish me to convey the information to the young gentleman?
If you don't mind, Stevens.
Well, I will do my best, sir. I may, however, have difficulty finding the appropriate moment to convey such information.
I'd be very grateful if you'd even try, Stevens. Awfully decent of you. Let me know how you get on.
It had been my intention to seek out an interview with Mr. Cardinal with minimum delay, but this proved to be impossible, owing largely to the arrival that same afternoon, some 2 days earlier than expected, of Mr. Lewis, the American senator. My recollection of Mr. Lewis is that of a gentleman of generous dimensions, with a genial smile that rarely left his face.
His early arrival was clearly something of an inconvenience to his lordship. However, Mr. Lewis's engagingly informal manner seemed to do much to win the confidence of his lordship's home team. As dinner progressed, the conversation had slowly but surely turned back to the conference ahead. At one point, Mr. Lewis said to the company, "I agree with you, gentlemen. Our Monsieur Dupont can be very unpredictable, but," he continued, "you can hardly blame a Frenchman for hating the Germans, can you?" There was a moment of slight awkwardness. Then Lord Darlington said, "Naturally, some bitterness is inevitable, but then, of course, we English also fought the Germans long and hard." "Ah, but the difference with you Englishmen," Mr. Lewis said, "seems to be that you don't really hate the Germans anymore." And there was another awkward pause before Sir David said, "We English have often had a different way of looking at things from the French, Mr. Lewis." "Ah, a kind of temperamental difference, you might say." Mr. Lewis's smile seemed to broaden slightly as he said this. "It is possible this is a case of hindsight colouring my memory, but I have a distinct feeling that it was at that moment I first sensed something odd, something duplicitous, perhaps, about this apparently charming American gentleman. But if my own suspicions were aroused at that moment, Lord Darlington evidently did not share them."
"Mr. Lewis," he said, "let me put it frankly. Most of us in England find the present French attitude despicable. It is unbecoming to go on hating an enemy like this once a conflict is over. To us, the French behaviour has become increasingly barbarous."
This utterance seemed to give Mr. Lewis some satisfaction. He muttered something in sympathy and smiled with contentment at his fellow diners. The following day brought several more guests, and Darlington Hall was filled with people of all nationalities. It was in the midst of dealing with the many demands being made on my attention that I spotted the young Mr. Cardinal taking some fresh air around the grounds. I could see that if I were to go outside and conceal my person behind the large rhododendron bush beside the path, it would not be long before Mr. Cardinal came by. I would then be able to emerge and convey my message to him. I fear I rather startled the young gentleman. "Oh, my goodness, you gave me quite a fright. If I may come to the point, sir, you will notice the geese not far from us."
"Geese?"
He looked around a little bewildered. "And likewise the flowers and the shrubs." "Well, to be perfectly frank, Stevens, I wasn't paying much attention to the glories of nature. That Monsieur Dupont's arrived in the foulest mood imaginable."
"Monsieur Dupont has arrived at the house, sir?"
"About half an hour ago."
"Oh, well, excuse me, sir, I must attend to him straight away. As it happened, I had a word or two more to say on the topic of the glories of nature, but I'm afraid this will have to wait for another occasion. You must excuse me," and I hurried back to the house.
Monsieur Dupont was a tall, elegant gentleman with a grey beard and a monocle. He had not arrived in a good temper. He had obtained some painful sores on his feet while sightseeing around London, and these, he feared, were growing septic. I referred his valet to Miss Kenton, but this did not prevent Monsieur Dupont snapping his fingers at me every few hours to say, "Butler, I am in need of more bandages." His mood seemed to lift on seeing Mr. Lewis. He and the American greeted each other as old colleagues, and they were to be seen together for much of the remainder of that day. Mr. Lewis apart, however, the other guests kept a wary distance from Monsieur Dupont, which seemed to underline all the more the feeling that it was Monsieur Dupont who somehow held the key to the outcome of the following days.